This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, October 13, 2005. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The U.S. and China announced that they have failed to reach an agreement on textiles. An anti-affirmative action group sues the Los Angeles Unified School District for the district's efforts on desegregation. And in Bolivia, indigenous Aymaras remember a historic battle in El Alto 2 years ago. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Hundreds of students clashed with policemen today during a march towards the presidential palace in the Philippines. Police arrested 10 for illegal assembly. Girly Linao reports from Manila.
Approximately 300 student activists marched in Manila today demanding the ouster of President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo over allegations of election fraud. They were also challenging a new hardline policy against rallies without permits. The policy has triggered violent dispersals of demonstrations in the past 3 weeks. A clash erupted as the students approached Mendola Bridge, several hundred meters from the Malacañang Presidential Palace. Around 100 policemen blocked the demonstrators and pushed them back with anti-riot shields. Officials claimed the students threw rocks at the policemen, prompting them to use water cannons. Arroyo's opponents have vowed to hold more street demonstrations in the coming days. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Girly Linao in Manila.
The European Union has now banned poultry imports from Romania and Turkey amidst fears of a bird flu pandemic. The ban was triggered by the discovery of a deadly strain of the aviary virus in Turkey, responsible for dozens of human deaths in Asia. Laboratory results from samples taken in Romania have yet to be announced. EU officials have called for an emergency meeting tomorrow in Brussels to discuss further measures. An outbreak of foot and mouth disease among cattle herds in southern Brazil has led Uruguay and Chile to close their borders to beef imports from southern Brazil. From Santiago, Jorge Garretón has more.
Chile's Agricultural and Livestock Service, the SAG, announced the ban as soon as the outbreak of foot and mouth disease was detected in southern Brazilian cattle. The SAG promptly alerted all border crossing personnel to the measure. Chile is a country free of foot and mouth disease due to strict controls. SAG efforts over the years have led to cattle herds free of foot and mouth disease without the use of vaccines. Other beef producers in South America must vaccinate their herds to prevent the crippling disease. Meanwhile, Brazil's neighbor Uruguay also closes borders to beef from the affected region. Despite the outbreak, government officials in both countries have dismissed rumors of increases in the price of meat, citing that other Brazilian regions are free of foot and mouth disease. Half of the meat consumed in Chile comes from Brazil. Chilean officials have now turned a vigilant eye to cattle from Paraguay that may be infected due to contact with Brazilian cattle. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
This in from South African correspondent Naeem Gina. A newly published United Nations report has found that the HIV/AIDS infection rate of Zimbabweans between the ages of 15 and 49 fell by nearly 5% in 2 years. The findings were part of a study conducted by UNAIDS, the U.S. Center for Disease Control, and a number of universities. The reduction in the infection rate has been attributed to widespread behavioral changes and increased consciousness about AIDS. Casual sex is on the decline, as is the number of people with sexually transmitted diseases. However, AIDS-related diseases continue to kill over 3,000 people every week in the southern African country. After Uganda, Zimbabwe is the second country in sub-Saharan Africa to see a drop in its HIV infection rates. Two Indian tribes in Connecticut are vowing to appeal yesterday's ruling by the U.S. Interior Department denying them federal recognition. Melinda Tuhus reports from New Haven.
The Interior Department reversed last year's ruling that had granted federal recognition to the Skaticokes and Eastern Pequots. State politicians were united in their opposition to federal recognition, fearing it would bring more Indian casinos into the state. The two Indian casinos already in Connecticut are among the biggest gambling operations in the world.
The tribes don't want to do a lot of things, but they don't want to lose their identity.
Skaticoke Tribal Chairman Richard Velke says that the costs of pursuing federal recognition often force tribes to ally themselves with outside interests they might prefer not to deal with, and those are most often gambling interests. Velke says politicians need to separate the issues of federal recognition and gaming.
Gaming was a right given to the tribes by the government back in 1988, but the scatter cooks started their petition in 1981. We actually started the land claim in 1970s. So our issues were in effect long before gaming even came about, and they're going to be in effect until we are successful in our bid for federal recognition.
The Interior Department ruled the tribes did not qualify for federal recognition because they could not prove they had existed as a tribe through the centuries, forming an intact cultural and social community. The tribes vehemently disagree and say they will appeal the decision in federal court. For FSRN, I'm Melinda Tuhus in New Haven.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
The U.S. and Chinese governments announced today that they have failed to reach an agreement on textiles. This comes as a surprise to many as China struck a similar deal on textiles with the European Union in June. But as Darby Hickey reports, labor unions and industry leaders say the Bush administration is not doing enough to deal with what they call China's manipulation of its currency. In Washington, Darby Hickey reports.
The nation's trade deficit grew in August, according to the Department of Commerce, reaching its third highest level on record. The U.S. imported $59 billion more in goods and services than it exported. Talks between the U.S. and China were meant to address parts of the trade deficit. With the failure of the talks, Chinese textile exports to the U.S. will continue to face heavy restrictions until the two governments reach a trade deal. The negotiations began in response to the rapid increase in Chinese textile production and exports over the past years since World Trade Organization rules changed the global textile industry, says Todd Tucker, research director with Public Citizen's Global Trade Watch.
What's been happening for the last 10 months has been a global and dramatic relocation of textile and apparel production from other parts of the world to China. And this has meant a sharp increase in the amount of imports of textile and apparel coming from China into the United States, which has angered a lot of the textile and apparel workers and manufacturers in the United States.
But Bush administration trade policy is failing U.S. industry and workers on many fronts, according to Richard Trimka of the AFL-CIO. Trimka joined industry leaders and economists today in criticizing the lack of a response to Chinese financial policy, which he and others say results in Chinese currency being artificially undervalued. By preventing its currency, the yuan, from inflating, China gives itself an unfair advantage in production, says Trimka.
It's estimated that over 60%, 60% of the products imported from China to the United States come from American firms doing business in China. That means that America's multinational companies are profiting handsomely from the Chinese government's deliberate undervaluation of its currency. And you've got to ask yourself, is that why our government has been so awful, awful, awful slow to act?
Those same corporations that benefit from the controlled Chinese currency ought to face consequences in the U.S., says Fred Redman, Assistant Director for District 7 of the United Steelworkers Union in Gary, Indiana. He and other union members are in D.C. this week educating themselves about trade policy and sharing their views on the effects as seen from factory floors.
We think that that's a responsibility that should be held through these trade agreements and through the U.S. government to bring these companies to task. But one of the things that we're pleased is that a lot of these companies have seen the light and through efforts by this coalition came to see that this affects both of us. But for those companies who want to, endorse the manipulation in order for profit, then we think that the U.S. government should be held accountable to bring those people to task.
But China is not the only country to adopt fiscal policy that benefits itself, says Todd Tucker of Global Trade Watch. He says the U.S. does the same thing and could change the playing field by altering its own practices.
Throughout the 1990s, the Clinton administration had a policy of keeping a very high level for the dollar, and we're still seeing the effects of that. And it would be up to Congress, if they chose to lower the value of the dollar by requiring the Treasury to take action on exchange rate policy. They could do that. Another way of doing it is trying to add pressure on China to raise the value of its currency. They're both different ways of accomplishing the same thing.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Between the 11th and the 15th of October 2003 in Bolivia, 60 indigenous Aymara people were killed and over 400 were seriously injured when blocking the streets of El Alto City from trucks that were exporting Bolivian gasoline. El Alto is perched 4,100 meters above the Bolivian capital of La Paz and is home to the largest Aymara population in the world. 2 years later, the battle in the Aymara city is remembered and the people who died fighting are honored. Diletta Varlesi reports.
Years have passed since what has come to be known as the October Massacre. In October 2003, former President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada called a national emergency and issued a decree declaring that any action taken against people and property were allowed in order to protect the country gasoline's exportation for the country's sake. The army was ordered to take El Alto under control in order to let the gasoline trucks cross the city and head towards the border. But Puente Rico, the main access way, were completely blocked by 20,000 Aymara men and women. Unable to pass, the 100 tanks instead went through Villa Ingenio Quarter. Six tanks entered the quarter with 500 police officers shooting indiscriminately at men and women and children in the streets and at their homes. About 60 people died in half an hour, and those injured could not be transferred to hospital because the inhabitants were locked in the quarter by police. The struggle went on for 6 days until Sánchez de Lozada escaped to the United States.
This kind of massacre cannot remain in a state of impunity.
Néstor Salina is president of the Fallen's Relative Association. The group is pursuing an international petition for the former president's extradition to be judged and condemned for genocide in Bolivia.
We had to exhume our relatives to obtain the two-thirds votes in the parliament to bring Sánchez de Lozada and his ministers to court. Nine of them are accused, but none of those ministers have been to court, and the parliament has not taken further action against the former president who's still in the U.S. We asked the U.S. embassy to extradite him.
The government paid the relatives 50,000 bolivianos, or about $7,000 in damages, plus funeral expenses. About the same amount was awarded to the wounded, but no additional support was provided to the widows, who did not receive any other support, not even for basic needs. And it's the same situation for people who were left disabled as a result of the attacks. Many survivors have now dedicated their lives to an association that is partly helping to support some of their relatives, supported by foreign donations. Hilda is a 26-year-old widow with a 3-year-old child. Her husband, Romero, was 22 when he was killed during the October 11th massacre.
Three strangers came to my house telling me he was injured and at the hospital. When I stepped outside of the house, my neighbors told me he was dead.
A team of lawyers working with various human rights groups has sent a formal request to the U.S. to extradite Goni Sánchez de Lozada and other two ministers, Carlos Sánchez Berzaín, former Minister of Defense, also known as the Angel of Death, and Gore Beridual, former Minister of Hydrocarbons. All were granted asylum by the U.S. In June of this year, attorneys received a confirmation that their requests were received, but no additional information has been offered by the U.S. government. Rogelio Maita is a spokesperson for the legal team.
During this 2 years, we saw a kind of ghost hand operating behind the scenes. As long as the U.S. government won't accept the request to extradite, we cannot proceed with the trial because we could be accused of damaging the right of defense. I want to underscore that Bolivia and the U.S. have an agreement to cooperate in the pursuit of criminals.
For Free Speech Radio News, Diletta Varlese in La Paz, Bolivia.
For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. Despite claims by the local government in Indian-administered Kashmir, many of the people affected by Saturday's devastating earthquake in the region have yet to receive assistance in the form of government aid. The relief supplies are pouring in, particularly as a result of local donations. The pace of getting the relief material to people in need has been sluggish. From Indian-administered Kashmir, Shahnawaz Khan reports.
It's 6 days now since a high-intensity earthquake caused havoc in Kashmir. Divided by a line of control between India and Pakistan, both parts of Kashmir bore the brunt of the quake, although on the Indian side the toll was relatively less. But even 6 days after the quake, many villages in Indian-administered Kashmir affected badly have not received any help.
Blankets, 79,765. Tents, jo abhi tak receive hue hain, 2,288. Medicines and boxes, fluids, 1,417.
Chief Minister of Jammu and Kashmir, Mufti Muhammad Said, detailing the relief work done by the state government. On ground, however, the government machinery is invisible. Abdul Hamid lives in village Dringla in Karna, close to the line of control.
We have received no help from the administration. It has been 6 days now. Whatever help comes is going to influential people.
With donations from local people, truckloads of essential supplies have reached mostly from Srinagar to the affected areas. But taking it to all the needy people is a tough task. Lack of coordination among numerous volunteers and an invisible state machinery in remote parts makes it difficult for volunteers to distribute the relief fairly. Landslides blocking access to hamlets in the hilly region is the biggest hurdle. The separatist group Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front is asking for international aid. Yasin Malik, the chairman of JKLF, has been actively leading the relief work of his group. Yasin wants international aid groups to be allowed in Indian-administered Kashmir, something India has not accepted so far.
We have been providing relief for the last few days, but the people in Tangar and Uri need immediate shelter, and only the international aid groups can provide that. So I appeal to the government of India that they should allow them, keeping politics aside.
Malik also plans to travel to Pakistan-administered Kashmir to provide assistance there. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan from Srinagar, Kashmir.
An anti-affirmative action group is suing the Los Angeles Unified School District, charging that its desegregation efforts are in violation of Proposition 209, a 1996 measure that banned racial preference in state-run institutions. From KPFK in Los Angeles, FSRN's Leilani Albano reports.
Supporters of Proposition 209, the measure banning affirmative action in California, filed two lawsuits today against the Los Angeles Unified School District, alleging that the district violates the 1996 initiative. The American Civil Rights Foundation, led by conservative Ward Connerly, who authored the anti-affirmative action bill, is heading the initiative. Sharon Brown is principal attorney for the Pacific Legal Foundation. She says that although voters overwhelmingly agree to prohibit preference by race, the school district continues to do so through the LAUSD's desegregation measures. They include magnet schools, voluntary busing, and using race and ethnicity as a factor in determining where to locate teachers. Today, the LA school district, the nation's second largest, serves a predominantly student of color population, with Hispanic non-whites making up only 9% of the schools. Sharon Brown.
The school district is discriminating against students and teachers, and any discrimination on the basis of race is wrong for whatever purpose. And there is no reason for the school district to continue with this discrimination.
But Kevin Reed, who is general counsel for the LAUSD, discounts her argument. He says that although affirmative action foes successfully passed 209, LAUSD was able to sidestep the bill due to a federal law that overrides the state measure.
Well, I'm surprised and disappointed that Mr. Connerly and the Pacific Legal Foundation would file this litigation. It is a real attack on one of the great successes that the school district has had in educating kids in an integrated environment.
The Pacific Legal Foundation filed a previous case against the LAUSD, stating that the district was in violation of Proposition 209. The case alleged that a white teacher at Van Nuys High School was unjustly discriminated against because he was prevented from changing jobs due to his race. The foundation's efforts will not stop in Los Angeles. If successful, Brown says the LAUSD will be one of many school districts throughout the state that the foundation will be suing. For FSRN, I'm Leilani Albano in Los Angeles.
For California voters, the November 8th special election is fast approaching. Several important issues will be up for grabs, with numerous propositions on the ballot. Many people outside the state are keeping a close watch as national trends often follow California. Grace Turner reports.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger didn't want to approach his November 8th special election, facing an all-time popularity low. But according to recent polls, California voters are lukewarm to downright hostile regarding Schwarzenegger's special election initiatives. Four propositions that seek to restrict teacher tenure, limit state spending, stop legislators from drawing their own district lines, and lessen labor unions' political power. The last in particular, titled Prop 75, has started a war with the state's nurses, teachers, and firefighters. The so-called Paycheck Protection Act would require labor unions to get explicit written permission from their members yearly before using dues money to engage in political activity. Bonnie Martin of the California Nurses Association Board of Directors says Prop 75 would be an administrative nightmare.
People have already given permission to use that money because they can choose not to allow that money right now to be used for those activities. So it's a useless amendment. And what I find particularly offensive is proponents of this proposition always say the union wants this money. Well, I am the union.
Charles Idelson, CNA's communication director, says the average corporation is spending more than $200,000 to help the governor fight the citizens of California. He asks, how can an individual nurse compete with that level of influence?
Corporations now outspend working people by 20 to 1 or 40 to 1 in virtually every election that occurs. Presently in California, we have the pharmaceutical industry, which has already collected about $78 million and intends to get to $100 million just on this one election campaign to pass one of the ballot measures, which would essentially prohibit the state from implementing effective price controls on these outrageous price gouging pharmaceutical corporations.
AB 583, a bill sponsored by California State Legislator Lonnie Hancock, would bring about public financing of elections in California. Similar to successful programs already in place in Arizona and Maine, the California Nurses Association has endorsed this bill, which they say sets an even playing field.
Right-wing, right-to-work groups around the country are hoping to emulate Proposition 75 in other states around the country.
When asked if he would stop taking donations from corporations if Proposition 75 passed, Schwarzenegger responded that he's actually looking out for the little guy.
What is important is that every person that contributes to political campaigns is asked if it is okay that you take money out of their wallet or out of their profits or whatever it is. It's that simple. We are fighting for the right of the workers.
Depending on whose figures one looks at, the governor is spending between $35 and $80 million on his November 8th special election. And he's enlisted the support of Arizona Republican Senator John McCain, who appeared in California earlier this week. Opponents of the initiatives brought John Kerry to L.A. to rally the opposition. Both sides have said they plan to step up their fight leading up to November 8th. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Grace Turner.
Now, this is Utah Phillips, and I'm down here in Albuquerque, and I listen to Free Speech Radio News because I need to know the truth, and I can't get it from the top down. I get it from the people who are on the street, like the gentleman I'm talking to right now.
This week marks the World Day Against the Death Penalty, when Amnesty International and other organizations call for an end to capital punishment. Texas leads the nation in death sentences and executions, and in some ways personifies the fight over life and death. From Houston, Katie Heim has more.
Texas has executed 350 people since it reinstated the death penalty in 1982.
24% of these people came from Harris County, which includes Houston. Death penalty opponents have found common ground with some unlikely allies over the issue of the Houston crime lab, where mishandling of evidence led the chief of police to call for a moratorium on executions. Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty member David Atwood explains.
That request for a moratorium was rejected by the governor and other, quite frankly, right-wing politicians that are in the state. Don't want to do anything that would interfere with the death penalty and the executions, even if that means that we execute an innocent person. And I think that's disgraceful, but that's basically what their attitude is.
Texas death penalty opponents celebrated a victory this year. As of September 1, 2005, jurors hearing capital murder cases were allowed to consider the possibility of life without parole as an alternative to death. On September 14th, Frances Newton became the first black woman put to death in Texas since the Civil War, despite the wishes of the victim's family, who didn't want to see Newton executed.
The governor just denied. This is America.
That's right. Ain't nothing changed.
Get real.
Don't be surprised.
Don't be surprised now.
For many, the Newton execution sums up all that is wrong with capital punishment. A poor woman of color, with less than adequate defense, convicted on evidence processed by the Houston Crime Lab. Other family members who have lost loved ones search for solace in a project called The Journey of Hope from Violence to Healing. Bill Pelkey describes his organization's mission.
We do traveling speaking tours around the country and around the world, sharing our stories of From Violence to Healing and talking about how the death penalty has absolutely nothing at all to do with the healing that murder victim family members need after a loved one has been killed. In fact, how it just increases the cycle of violence and continues the cycle of violence and creates more murder victim family members.
Overall, this year has been a high watermark for death penalty opponents. The Supreme Court abolished the death penalty in juvenile cases in March, and New York blocked reinstatement of capital punishment in April. Death Penalty Information Center's Executive Director, Richard Dieter.
The Supreme Court also overturned a number of cases from Texas, where, of course, most executions are carried out. And so they found racial bias in jury selection and other problems with the way Texas's death sentences were carried out. They also overturned a Pennsylvania case because of inadequate representation. All of these are things that 5 or 10 years ago might have gone the other way, and in some cases did go the other way in votes in the legislature, and there's been a groundswell of change.
The effect of the recent appointment of John Roberts as new Chief Justice of the Supreme Court on this and other issues remains to be seen. Reporting from Houston, I'm Katie Heim for Free Speech Radio News.
We don't have to go through this pain anymore. We're going to take it up, though. We don't have to do it no more.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations, WPFW in Washington, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFA in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington editor is Selena Musuta, sitting in for Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. Free Speech Radio News is an independent, worker-run collective. For more information, check out our website at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.